will come as an incredible shock. So please welcome Gordon Matthews.
Okay, you guys all probably know what Chungking Mansions is, that large hulking building in Kowloon. You may have walked by it, you know, and you walk by the entrance of it and you see numbers of Africans and South Asians. It's interesting that among Hong Kong Chinese, this building is terrifying. You look in websites and you see, it's a heart of darkness in there. I walked by and there were black people, brown people. And that's what you see on websites. But if you travel to places like Kathmandu, Kolkata, Kampala, as I have, and ask about Chungking Mansions, what you see is people grinning. They're saying, wow, what a great place to go. My cousin went there and he made a lot of money. Chungking Mansions, for much of the world, is not a hellhole, but it's a beacon of hope. Because it's where you can make a living. You can get out of the developing world and make potentially a fortune. Most people lose their shirts, but it's possible you won't. Chungking Mansions is significant because it's a world center of what I call low-end globalization. That's not the globalization of McDonald's, Sony, you know, all these Coca-Cola, all these big companies with their multi-billion dollar budgets and, you know, hundreds or thousands of lawyers. Low-end globalization is where you got a lone African trader who wanders into Chungking Mansions with a suitcase, carries back 32 kilograms of phones back to Kampala, back to Lagos, and sells them in the market. This is globalization as enjoyed by probably 70% of the world's people, who know nothing about high-end globalization. They only know these traders bringing back their goods. And this is extraordinarily important. My estimate is that 20% of the phones now used in sub-Saharan Africa have come through Chungking Mansions. And that's economically a major matter. Now, let me talk a little bit about the research I did. I stayed in Chungking Mansions for 1 to 2 nights a week for about 4 years. What I did was just wander through the building, talking to everybody I met, traders, merchants, all kinds of people, asylum seekers, just finding out about their lives. And it was amazingly easy research. Much of what goes on in Chungking Mansions is, of course, illegal. But it's not morally illegal, it's more technically illegal. It's an illegality of copies, for example, or an illegality of people working illegally, but they're working illegally, you know, because they're tourists in Hong Kong. They're not supposed to be working. But this isn't a moral matter, and the Hong Kong government largely seems to tolerate this kind of thing because it puts money in Hong Kong people's pockets. This building was built in 1962, and it was originally a major, you know, new building in Hong Kong that brought in celebrities living there and so on. It rapidly fell apart. By the late 60s, American GIs would go to Chungking Mansions with sex workers when they were on R&R from Vietnam. By the mid-70s, Lonely Planet came out, and Tony Wheeler's first book was saying, if you're in Hong Kong, the place to stay is Chungking Mansions. What this did was cause every property owner in the building to promptly leave their flat and instead subdivide it into 12 tiny rooms, each with its own air conditioner, each with its own television. Well, that's going to just overburden the power grid enormously. And so by the late 80s, you had fires. By the early 90s, you had blackouts lasting 10 days. It really did become a hellhole because it couldn't support all that use of the building. But the building continued to change. You still see Lonely Planet backpackers, often older now. You know, I see people in their 60s and 70s coming in with large beer bellies saying, back when I was here, when I, you know, 40 years ago, it was really different. You still see that. But now you see many more developing world workers. Numbers of Indians, numbers of African traders. Those are the people you most likely see in the building. Chungking Mansions exists for a number of reasons, but three are paramount. First of all is the building itself. You know, this is expensive real estate. How can it continue there? It can continue because for businesses in Chungking Mansions, what the key is to have as much volume coming in as possible. Don't raise your prices, keep it low. Why? African traders can't afford more than $120, $130 a night per bed. They can't afford expensive meals. Keep prices low, you make money off your volume. And this is what the merchants in Chungking Mansions all know very well. So the building continues to be, again, in the heart of Chimchachoy, 100 yards from the peninsula, it continues to be the center of really, really, really cheap goods and lodging and food in Hong Kong. The second reason the building exists has to do with Hong Kong. If an African trader, say from Tanzania, from Kenya, or a South Asian trader from India, were to fly to the US, Australia, Japan, they'd be turned back in the next plane. In Hong Kong, you can get in without visa access, visa-free entry, and this enables these traders to come in. The third reason is, of course, China and its development as a world center of low-end manufacturing. You know, now many people talk about China as being a world center of globalization, but China's major function in the world today is it brings globalization to the world's poor. It's cheap, shoddy, often copy goods are all that people in Africa and South Asia can afford. So I think when the economic history of the 21st century is written, China's major role will be it brought globalization to the people in the world who couldn't afford it. And that's what China does, and that's why Chungking Mansions exists as it does. Now, let me talk very briefly, and I'm going to be very brief here because your questions are more important, about the people in Chungking Mansions. The owners. The owners often are mainland Chinese who came into Hong Kong in the 70s and 80s and bought property in the one place they could afford, Chungking Mansions. They lived out the Hong Kong dream. And, you know, every now and then I have a student come up to me in my classes saying, my mother owns a guest house in Chungking Mansions, but now I'm in university. I want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher. I don't want to be in Chungking Mansions. That's living out the Hong Kong dream. Your kids will do better than you. And these kids want nothing to do with Chungking Mansions. The managers often of these places are South Asian. And they're South Asians who've lived in Hong Kong for generations, but they, unlike the mainland Chinese, are deeply upset about Hong Kong racism. They want to be in the one place in Hong Kong that doesn't seem like Hong Kong. That is Chungking Mansions. Why? Well, you can get Indian TV, Pakistani TV, Nepalese TV in the building. You have huge numbers of DVDs from India available. Mass media is widespread. Again, Chungking Mansions is South Asia, and that's where they feel at home. Another group, though, many of the people these people hire are temporary workers from Kolkata. I flew back to Kolkata with one temporary worker, and he described the situation. He has 14 days to live in Hong Kong. He can extend his visa twice. That's 42 days. If he flies back and forth, Bangladesh Airways, he can pay for his flight by carrying clothes back and by carrying Indian food to Hong Kong. And he does this time after time after time. He makes his living working as a temporary worker in Hong Kong for $3,000 a month. But that brings him a lot of money. Back home, he is a hero. He's paid for his sister's weddings. He's rebuilt the family house. He's got a shiny new motorcycle. And it was interesting in this Kolkata neighborhood of Kidderpur. I went there knowing no one. And I was walking in the street. And then one guy, hi, professor, how are you? Remember, I'm from Chungking Mansions, fourth floor, B block. You know, another guy, hi, I'm from Chungking Mansions, 16th floor, E block. You know, that's what you see. They're coming from Kolkata, which is amazing. The dominant group you see in Chungking Mansions are the traders from Africa. And they're coming in with their empty suitcases, ready to buy particularly mobile phones, clothing, computers, watches, other goods too, but mobile phones are the major goods. And often they're used mobile phones, copy mobile phones. Some of them are 14-day, which are Nokia phones that have been returned by their original owner that now are 40% of their original prices. There's a whole array of phones, but this is a huge business, and many, many people, many thousands of people make their living by going back and forth, getting these phones. And that's a whole other interesting matter. I spent several months behind the counter of a phone stall, just looking at how the African traders and Pakistani merchants negotiated with each other. Absolutely amazing. Other people in the building, asylum seekers. I teach a class of asylum seekers every week at Chungking Mansions. These are people who have come to Hong Kong often because they've been politically persecuted or sometimes for economic benefit. They want to be able to make a living here. And they have extremely tough lives because the government doesn't give them enough money to survive. So they're basically forced to work. And if you go up in the elevators in Chungking Mansions, you can see many Africans and South Asians working, hoping that they don't get caught. And because it's so difficult to catch anybody in Chungking Mansions, they usually don't. After all, police come in the door and instantly everybody's on their phone. Hey, police are here. And going up an elevator takes 10 or 15 minutes. Anybody working can step outside. Oh, I'm just standing around. Can't catch them. That's what you see. There are other people there, too. There are maybe 50 or so heroin addicts in back, mostly the sons of Gurkhas. They're Nepalese, and overwhelmingly, it's Nepalese who take heroin. Fascinating. Sex workers, numbers of East African sex workers, numbers of East Indian sex workers. Again, you got a building that's predominantly male. You've got 4,000 people in there. This is hardly surprising, but that's part of the building, too. Domestic helpers. Your domestic helpers may be there on Sunday. Have a look. You know, that's fascinating. The whole place really is a United Nations. Tourists, too. And I've seen tourists from basically every country in the globe, it seems. I've counted 130 nationalities in the building by looking at guest house logs. It truly is a miniature United Nations. That's what we see. Now, the question that I've asked a lot is, why do these people get along so well? There are fights. You see occasional fights between an African trader and a Pakistani dealer of phones. I mean, these happen. And the police in Chimchachoy have been pretty good to try and arrange an African community to manage to end these fights. They've done a pretty good job of it. But, of course, they break out from time to time. But I remember asking a Pakistani guy, look, you hate Indians, don't you? Oh, I hate Indians. But you're working for this Indian guy. How can you do that? He looked at me and said, he has to make money and I have to make money. We don't have time to fight. Which is an interesting line, but that really is one reason why Chungking Mansions works. Who are the people there? They are not, despite the Hong Kong myth, the poor of the developing world. No, they're the rich of the developing world. Who the hell else can come to Chungking Mansions? They're the people who can afford a plane ticket from Somalia, from Pakistan, from Nigeria, from Ghana, to come to Chungking Mansions halfway around the world. Very often, the traders are people, their families have pooled together their money to send their young son, you know, their young man of a son, to Chungking Mansions to see if he can make a fortune. So you're not looking at people who are absolutely the down and out, even among the asylum seekers, who often have had to pay US $8,000 to manage to get to Hong Kong. You're looking at the developing world successful. That's why Chungking Mansions is as peaceful as it is. You know, this is a club like this. You and the people in Chungking Mansions are remarkably similar, I would say. Yeah. Okay, just a couple of other points. Illegality in the building. The police, by and large, seem to look the other way, largely because of impotence. There's nothing they can do. I think intelligent people in Chungking Mansions realize that if they get picked up, just speak the most obscure language you know. Speak Twi, speak Hausa. It costs a lot of money to get interpreters. And what you see in Chungking Mansions is not real criminality. I've seen it very often. If a fight breaks out, police are in there in 30 seconds. If there's a serious robbery, police are there in 30 seconds. But copy goods, since buyer and seller both know what they're buying, no, no. Or illegal labor, since, again, everybody knows the game, nah, don't worry about it. Occasionally, mass media force the police to act, but mostly the police are fairly laissez-faire, and I think for good reason, because this is not hurting Hong Kong people. Now, I believe, just to finish up here, that Chungking Mansions is a beacon of multicultural tolerance and should be cherished. It's the only place in the world like this. There are certainly multicultural neighborhoods. I think of Flushing in Queens in New York. London certainly has a number of these. Guangzhou does in its own way. Various places do. But Chungking Mansions, as a single building where everybody is in each other's faces, as you can see from these various pictures I've got, there's no other place like this, really. And again, this is something fairly important. It should be cherished. In this particular picture, you know, the Africans and the Chinese and the Indians may not be talking to each other, but if you're in Chungking Mansions enough, they do. They get to know each other. And that's quite extraordinary that that should be the case. Is this going to continue? What's going to happen to the building? Well, the real estate is awfully valuable. As people in Chungking Mansions have told me, nobody hates money. You know, if somebody comes in and offers enough money to sell out, they probably will. There's 900 different owners of Chungking Mansions, owners association shares. So you'd have to do a lot of negotiating. But come on, you've got all those shopping malls right next door. You know, clearly soon enough, the place will be bought out. But even though Chungking Mansions can't last forever, I think the world is going to become more and more like Chungking Mansions. Why? Because you will see increasing numbers of developing world people coming to the developed world. They want to make their living. If I was from Nigeria, if I was from Pakistan, I would come to Chungking Mansions. I'd become an asylum seeker. I'd do my best to make money or do whatever I had to do. This is what the world's going to see. And what I'd want to say to you in closing is that if all the world's going to become like Chungking Mansions, it's a pretty good world. There's nothing to be afraid of. Thank you.
Well, doesn't that make you want to go back to university? Professor, you can be seated for questions if you like.
Except I gotta monitor the pictures. I'm moving them myself. Well,
anyway, anyone who's got questions, please raise your hand and identify yourself. Down the front here, wait for the microphone.
Thanks. About 4 or 5 years, my name is Paul Murray, I'm a medic in town here. But 4 or 5 years ago, I used to do a clinic in Chungking Mansions, Saturday afternoon, 16th floor, I think D block.
Yeah.
And predominantly, the Africans there were from French West Africa, from Togo, from Côte d'Ivoire, and Benin, I think, and somewhere else. Almost all Congo, too. Has that changed? I had so much so that I had to bring a French dictionary to work when I went there.
I think you were not on D block, but E block, Christian Action.
Could be.
Yeah, I think that's where you were. And it has indeed, it hasn't changed. There are numbers of Africans from French-speaking areas. Obviously, you know, it's important what you did. For clinics, you just don't know who comes in on any given day. But what is true is that for the asylum seekers you were working with, most of them can get Hong Kong care, well, with a little bit of difficulty, but they can do it. I think the French speakers would be more shut out because Hong Kong doctors just wouldn't have time to deal with them, and I see that a lot. I have been dealing a lot with a French-speaking asylum seeker who's been beaten up by CID recently, and I'm trying to create some disturbance over this and create publicity for it. But it's tough because he can't talk to the press because his English is so bad. And so I think the French speakers are left out, and this leads to a larger issue of what languages work in Chungking Mansions. Overwhelmingly, it exists because of English. And if you go into China, into Guangzhou, you will see traders who don't know English but are struggling with Mandarin because English isn't a lingua franca there. Chungking Mansions, it is English. And so the people you're dealing with are those who thought, wow, maybe this man we can communicate in French with. They're using you as a resource, and it's terrific you were able to do that. Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Over here.
Hi, Ted Kavouras from Panoramic Consulting. First of all, I think we should have had a very spicy curry for lunch instead of the chicken, but that's beside the point. I do take umbrance on your lack of interest and flippancy toward intellectual property violations. And the fact that they're selling fake phones is a big issue. I mean, it's pretty much the only place that's lawless like this in Hong Kong. And that's why we live in Hong Kong, because it's a country of laws. I work with as an investigator, and we, on a regular basis, have to go undercover and have people arrested. And I think it's important to do that. I don't think this globalization outweighs intellectual property, which is what's keeping the world's economy together. Thank you.
Well, I wish I could see your face.
Right on here.
You know,
actually, I'm undercover.
Okay, I see, yeah. We fundamentally disagree. And I have spoken to people working for Nokia, because it is mobile phones I deal with more than anything else. And off the record, they have told me that they don't really care. That's what they've said, and this is off the record. On the record, they never said that, but they said. And here's why, and listen to me a bit. They said this because they don't think that the people who buy copies are in direct competition with the people who buy real phones. Their view, and the view this particular person from Nokia said, was somebody in Nigeria may buy a copy Nokia 6400, for example, when they're 20, knowing that it's a copy. When they're 30, they'll buy the real thing. They don't have the money because copies are 40% or 50% of the original, but they will. They know the difference. No. I've been to Africa a number of times. I've done research into this. It's not an assumption. You haven't. You have your particular axe to grind, and I can appreciate it. These who pay your salary. But nonetheless, it's rather apparent if you travel through Africa, talk to people, that this is not what you're describing, because overwhelmingly the buyers of these know what a copy is and what a genuine article is. Now, if they didn't, hear me out, stop talking and listen. If they didn't, what you'd see is that, I mean, I agree with you. If consumers are being sold copy phones as if they were original, that's a real problem. I totally agree with you. That should not happen. From all I hear, though, that doesn't happen very much. I really haven't heard that going on. And even phone merchants tell me nobody ever comes in bringing a copy phone asking it to be repaired. Real Nokia places. And I've been to real Nokia places in Lagos and in Kampala. I mean, I know this. I've investigated this. I doubt you believe that. But look, if I'd like to get to know you, let's go out for a drink. I'd like to talk to you for a couple hours. Is that okay? I'm serious now. I really want to talk. You might teach me something. Okay, fair enough.
up the frontier. Yeah.
Hello, and thank you so much for this wonderful talk. I'm Bonnie Engel, a freelance writer. You said that the Chungking Mansions is predominantly male. Could you talk a little bit more about the female element there, and not just sex workers, but if there are other people living there, and are there children, are there families and children?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and you're right, I didn't deal with that much here. There are indeed, one set of women are African female traders, and often they're older, dealing in clothing. It's a relatively small percentage of the traders you see, but the word I get from male traders is we don't understand how fashions change as well as they do, and so that definitely exists. It's difficult for me to talk to them much because the one time I really got to know a female trader, she promptly called me up and said, "It's my birthday, why did you forget?" I mean, I need to be careful about this kind of involvement. With my female students, I've had problems when they want to work in Chungking Mansions. My rule has always been anybody who wants to work in Chungking Mansions, I'll let them do it. I would pay them for it. But overwhelmingly, they would be harassed. And they wouldn't be harassed physically, but it would more, you want to interview me? Well, let's go back to my room. We can have more fun there. I mean, that's what they would always hear. And one student came up to me and said, "Why does anybody in Chungking Mansions only think about sex?" Which is what you heard. And it's because it's as such a male environment, it's sort of like a prison would be. I mean, it's 90% male, and so people are always assuming, why would a woman come in here? And I have one, sorry, I'm more salacious than your question warranted, but one story was really interesting about this. I used to take my graduate students to Chungking Mansion sometimes. I mean, I have a female student, maybe she's graduated, and she wants to have dinner, I'll take her there. And I remember being looked at strangely by numbers of Muslims I knew. And to me, I mean, it's perfectly ordinary to take a woman to dinner if you're not involved with her. But they all thought, why is he talking to these young women? And one night a BBC reporter came to Chungking Mansions, and I'd warned her, but she was dressed in overly revealing clothing, a short skirt. I mean, you get the idea. And everybody was staring. And I thought, this is trouble. What am I going to do? So I got rid of her really quickly, and I went to my room, and I fell asleep. Then at midnight, there was this loud knock on the door. Police! Police! I opened the door. No, it was 8 Muslim guys. And they were all going to beat me up. They were all looking like this, and a couple had sticks. And then they took a look in my room and saw that it was empty. Nobody was in my bed. And they all sort of went, "We're sorry. We're checking the room for tomorrow to see if anyone's in here." You know, and I talked to them later. They felt that because I was a professor, if I was using Chungking Mansions as a place for sexual liaisons, that was inappropriate. And I think they were right. And I, of course, never did. But that was the feeling, and that's part of the cross-cultural gap that goes on. For many Muslims, you know, the idea of talking to a woman is really strange. You don't talk to a woman. One of my student helpers made the mistake of shaking hands with a Pakistani phone dealer, and he promptly sent, 1,000 emails over the course of a week. "We're in love. I can't live without you." And, you know, that's what you see. It's a different world in that sense. And it's not physically dangerous at all because people are following rules here. I've never heard of anybody assaulted there. But still, it's unnerving for young women coming in because probably Chungking Mansions is 50, 60, 70% Muslim. And there is this idea that this is a place where women should not be. One last story, because you've hit a vein of many rich stories. I remember talking to one Indian guy who was Muslim, who I asked him, "Are you coming back to Chungking Mansions next time, or are you going to stop?" I'm going to stop. Why? Well, because women outside, you know, you see these women, these Hong Kong girls, and they're in really short skirts. And if I asked them for their phone number, they might give it to me. I'd hate for my family to be in such an immoral place. I'm not coming back. I want to be in Mecca. Well, that's interesting, you know. And that's the spirit that he had. It makes perfect sense given his perceptions. But Chungking Mansions is weird because it does change the attitudes of people. I guess I got to tell one more story because there's so many. I remember seeing a Pakistani guy who I knew rather well. And at one particular moment when I began my research, there were a number of sex workers who came in, European. Women with plunging backs, blonde hair. I believe they were Ukrainian, but I couldn't really tell. And they had a huge crowd of people following them. And then he saw me staring at them, and he put his hand over my eyes, and he said, "Mister, don't look." Well, 2 weeks later, the same women came in, and I asked him, "Akbal, why aren't you putting your hand over my eyes?" And he just shrugged and said, "They have to make a living like I have to make a living." I mean, that's what happens in Chungking Mansions. You learn to accept all this stuff.
I think the sure. Next one was up the back here, and then over there. Yeah.
Gordon, thank you very much. Tim Pearson-Smith. I'm just wondering, you touched on the subdivided nature of the tenancies there. 20 years ago, I worked on a government study in West Kowloon, and we were looking at redevelopment opportunities for older areas. Now, back then, building that was 15 years old on the plan had realized its value, it amortized itself. The whole of West Kowloon, basically that was the rule, except for one piece of land, which was Chungking Mansions. And this was a direction from the planning department 20 years ago. Don't even go there. And I just wonder, you said 900 separate leases. I'm not an expert in this area, but I suspect it's probably a little bit more than that, because I think most of the developers in Hong Kong, if it was only 900 leases, would have found a way to aggregate the plot and redevelop it. So I just wonder, you know, the issues that you talked about, that having been in Hong Kong 21 years myself, you know, the fires, the sanitation, all of those different issues, how much is it a case that government just simply turns a blind eye as it did 20 years ago? And do you think it will ever be redeveloped? Or is it just going to be this bizarre, you know, as you said, the United Nations in another 20 years' time?
Yeah, interesting question. And you know more than I do. I've looked into real estate a bit to try and understand this, but you know, it's difficult for me to wrap my head around what the rules may be. I have heard that the Urban Renewal Authority won't tear down a building unless you can clearly make a profit from it. And so I've noticed in Kowloon, they might tear down a building of five stories, but 17 stories already has so much floor space that you'd be reluctant to tear it down. The 900 ownership shares, that's the figure that the Chungking Mansions Ownership Association gives to me. I assume that's accurate, but I also think that so much money can be made from that property that it may be one of these curious issues where even if rents are low, you don't want to keep the rents higher. You can make so much money by monthly business there that people aren't that encouraged to sell out for a higher profit. One more issue that I should mention, there's a woman named Mrs. Lam who is the head of the ownership committee. And she's fascinating to talk to because she understands nothing of what goes on in Chungking Mansions, but she also is extraordinarily dynamic. She speaks very little English, and so, you know, it's confusing for her, but she's the one who's put in the new elevators. She's the one who's put in the guard. She's been there about the last 10 years. Really an extraordinary force. And she has been very good at meeting all kinds of political figures in the Tsim Sha Tsui area and government relations. I go to the Chungking Mansions owner's dinner every year, and I always meet all these people I've never seen anywhere else. You know, police figures and owners of property who never come to the building. It's a totally different world. But she's so good at that. She smoothed everything over so well that actually she's won awards from the Hong Kong government for how well she's able to handle this property. So who knows how this works, but it does seem that she has managed to make a situation such that selling out is not something immediately on the agenda. And I've not heard of any corporation seeking to come in. Now, when she's upgrading the building, how much is she doing it with the ultimate end of selling out? I can't tell. I just don't know what the fate of the building is going to be. But so far, it certainly has managed well. And it's interesting, you mentioned 20 years ago, in the early 90s, you had all these newspaper articles coming out, tear down Chungking Mansions, tear it down. There were so many guest houses that were substandard. You don't see that much anymore. I think Michael Chugani in the South China Morning Post wrote a couple of weeks ago, tear down Chungking Mansions, but he was being lazy, I think. You know, let's just say something we said 20 years ago. You don't hear that voice much now because it doesn't quite have that atmosphere now. It is looking better. And over again, I hear from people who walk in the building, this is bourgeois now. It's not like it was back when I was young. So it is on an upward trajectory that makes it probably less likely. Now, the danger of fire, that's still there, but no one's died in the last 20 years in a fire in the building. So.
Okay, I think we had one over here. Yes, up the back here. And then back on the veranda, Sarah.
Thank you very much, Professor. My name is John Antweiler. I work for Wells Fargo Bank. And I'm curious, as a banker, to the extent that credit is used in Chungking Mansions, or whether the economy is strictly a cash economy, and if so, where are the traders getting financing? From their families? They go back to Nigeria and come back with a suitcase full of money and start buying the mobile phones? How does it all work?
Great question. I remember when I first began doing research in Chungking Mansions, I was in the 7-Eleven just around the corner on Modi Road, and I asked an African guy, how much money have you got? And he pulled out $40,000 in cash, U.S. dollars. And he had me count the money because he wanted me to believe how much he had. And I remember telling him, I have never held this much money in my entire life. I probably never owned this much money in my entire life. So it is a cash economy. And traders are really concerned about this. Numbers get their own rooms so that they won't have to deal with anyone else in there. Many are really careful with their pockets. Triads don't go into Chungking Mansions because they don't speak English, and it's fortunate they don't, because there's a lot of cash around that building, it seems. Many people do use various informal ways of sending money back and forth. There's a Pakistani means called the Hawali of people sending money back and forth, basically getting somebody, a friend, to take it back and paying a small commission on it rather than using Western Union or anything more formal. Africans do it too. And I know one guy named Dollar Man, a famous Nigerian, you know, always had basically millions upon millions of dollars. He was robbed 3 years ago by two Nigerians. And the Nigerian community in Hong Kong was so worried about their reputation going down that they themselves found the two culprits and took them into police. And then one guy said, by the way, I'm on your record, just expunge my record and I will give you this guy. So there's other reasons to do it. But they were concerned about preserving these trade networks. Now, the biggest issue of credit, and the most interesting, has to do with the relation between African traders and the sellers, often the Pakistani mobile phone sellers. And basically, it's much easier for the sellers to cheat the traders than vice versa, because the seller knows more about phones and can always, you know, raise the price $10 or $20. I should say, by the way, that the mobile phones don't have price stickers on them. So there's no set price. And I know how smart these sellers are. For example, one typical technique, this goes beyond your question, but one typical technique is a trader comes in and wants to buy one brand of phone, immediately mention another brand. And if the trader's heard of it, lower the price $10. If the trader hasn't heard of it, raise it $10. You know, it's that quick. These guys are really good. But traders have gotten back, and the way they get back is, let's say you get to know a phone seller over a period of years. You build up a relationship over maybe 5 years, and then you go to the phone seller and say, look, I want to make a really big order this time, but I need credit. You know, I want to buy $50,000 worth of phones, but I just don't have the cash now. Give them to me. You know me. We've been friends a long time. And so the trader will put together a huge shipment, the seller, and the trader will take them and then promptly vanish. And so the seller keeps trying to call Lagos saying, excuse me, I'm looking for Abdullah. Abdullah? There's nobody here by that name. Wham! You never see him again. Now, no traders told me this story. It's only phone sellers who tell me this story, so maybe give it a grain of salt. But this is one way in which credit can be abused, and it probably is true. Overall, credit is not used very much. It is a cash economy, largely because these Africans can't get credit, almost as a rule, and a letter of credit from their local banks isn't going to do any good. I hear that it's been changing in the last year, bit by bit, but not very much. It still is predominantly a cash economy.
Okay, Sarah, up the very, very back there. Keep it short and maybe we can sneak in a few more.
Hello, can't see you, but my name is Sarah, and I used to live in the Sailors and Soldiers home in Wan Chai, which was not nearly as exciting. Just would like to ask, to what extent do the diplomats in Hong Kong concern themselves with the affairs of this mini United Nations?
Yep. Good question. The short answer is practically none. I don't think they have any interest in this at all, really. The only need for diplomats is when people do have visa concerns, and that does happen. One place that traders occasionally go to is, of course, the place to get a China visa. But overwhelmingly, too, you get visas in Chungking Mansions itself. So I don't think there's much of any concern of diplomats. Now, one thing I don't know is, you know, clearly for really poor African countries, you don't have a consulate. You've got like one person who represents them. I've talked to a couple of those people and they know what's going on in Chungking Mansions, but not that much of a relation. So curiously, not much of a diplomatic relation at all, I don't think. One other issue, though, about this, a number of asylum seekers I know are terrified that their country back home has sent spies to look for them. Now, Chungking Mansions is a small place. Let's say you're an asylum seeker from Benin, from Guinea, from a relatively small African country. Traders come from there. They have their eyes out. Who's in Chungking Mansions? And some of the Africans I know will only take the stairs in the back of Chungking Mansions and not take the elevators to be as invisible as possible because they might be seen. Their families may be at danger back home. If this were the case, then the diplomats here in Hong Kong would actually, by representing the government, be a danger to these guys. But overall, it's amazing to me how little diplomats have had anything to do with what I've seen in Chungking Mansions.
Okay, any more? Okay, over here, yes.
Hello, Alex Butterfield, and I am a diplomat, and we don't really give a rat's ass about Chungking.
I like how you talk as a diplomat.
However, I have taken several house guests by, and one just recently, thanks, sent me your book off on Amazon.com. So, a world in microcosm. But are there larger lessons here? Is it just that, you know, if we are so busy making money that we won't war with each other? What kind of glimpse has this given you of the future or the large patterns?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. What is it? I'm going to reinterpret your question to say what it's taught me. Because until I did this research, I didn't know very much about the developing world. And Chungking Mansions is a rather poor representation of all that you could see in the developing world. But my biggest surprise has been how devoutly religious almost everybody I know is. You know, I think here, most people in here probably aren't particularly religious. Some may be, but most aren't. Every African, every South Asian I know really follows the Quran word for word or the Bible word for word. These people believe this to an extraordinary degree, and this affects trade as well. You know, I'll have traders telling me, merchants telling me, look, I can cheat this guy on mobile phones, but no more than 5% because Allah is watching me. And, you know, Allah knows what I'm doing, and Allah will allow a certain degree of profit, but not beyond a certain point. Or I'm talking to a merchant and we go back and look at the circulation in Mecca around the Kaaba. These guys believe this stuff. Or I'll be having a beer with an asylum seeker somewhere and he'll say, now it's time for me to talk to you about the Lord. This really is powerful, and that's fairly significant. When I talk to these guys, I realize that they do have a moral force in their life that I don't have, and most of you don't have. And that's fairly remarkable. I'd never realized that developing world, developed world gap quite as powerfully as I see. Is this a large-term lesson? Should we all become believers in Allah? No. But still, this is quite fascinating, and it's been amazing to me. The other thing I've learned, really, again, is how much fear developed world people seem to have of the developing world. And it's fairly remarkable how easy it is for me. Just one more example, and this isn't directly answering your question, but it's the only way I can really do it based on it. I would be fairly worried in the US of going up to a group of inner city blacks and having a beer with them. I'm not going to say, hey, have a beer, I'll drink one. They wouldn't know who I was. They'd think, you know, I was there for some sexual purpose. They might be thoroughly confused as to what I'm doing there. Chungking Mansion's absolutely not. Here's a guy here, he wants to talk, let's talk. And so just that degree of friendliness is rather extraordinary, how much people tell me things, and to the extent that it hurts them. You know, I remember going up to a Pakistani guy and saying, look, you're illegal, aren't you? Yeah, I'm illegal, but you're a professor. You won't tell the police. I know that. Why is he admitting this to me? Why is he telling me? So it's fairly remarkable, again, the degree of openness. I don't mean to say only good things about Chungking Mansions, because there are bad things, but I have been rather amazed by what I've seen there, and it certainly redeveloped my whole perception of what the developing world is. And when I fly to Africa now, when I fly to India, I have a wholly different perception of what I did a few years ago. And that's because I've sort of gone beyond that level of, you know, the people who prey on tourists looking for money into people there. It's just a remarkably friendly kind of place to be in, and this has taught me a great deal. So I guess if you're asking for a single lesson is, I don't believe we should be quite as terrified of the developing world as we are. Now, are you from the American consulate? Okay, one other issue I'd like to say to you particularly is a lot of asylum seekers I deal with are Somali. They are from various countries. You know, the asylum seekers I teach are extraordinary people. Some are smart, some aren't so smart, some are great at business, some are terrible at it, but I've never met a person who behaves in what I would consider to be an immoral way, and I've known these guys for 5 years. Be generous, as I think you are. Let these people in. You don't need to worry about Al-Qaeda blog. You know this stuff. I don't need to tell you. But there's no worry about Al-Qaeda membership and so on. I've never met anybody like Chungking Mansions who sympathizes with that. These people will really help the American economy, I think, and the developed world economies. These people have enough drive to really do a lot. One last story. My best friend in Chungking Mansions is a Pakistani guy who I first met when he was behind a counter of a phone stall. Now, as I got to know him better and better, he told me that he was getting paid $100 a month by his uncle. And he was told to say this is his brother, but immigration didn't believe it. He's an asylum seeker. He was getting paid so little that finally he turned himself into police. I met him 2 months later. I thought he'd been killed. I didn't know what was going on. When I met him, again, he had lost about 40 pounds. He'd been on the street, no money, no nothing. And he said, lend me $30,000. I can start a business. And I trusted him, so I lent him $30,000. 6 months later, we had a dinner. He gave me $30,000 back and a Rolex watch. Now, the Rolex broke after 2 weeks, but so I wouldn't say that, but still. But going on, now he is a leading wholesaler in Chungking Mansions. Now, this story gets deeper. He was seeing an Indonesian domestic helper. A lovely woman, and they were totally in love with each other. But if he married her, she would lose her job. He can't do that. They had to break up. And man, I was at their parting, and they were both sobbing. He realized the only way he could stay in Hong Kong is to marry a Hong Kong girl. So he wound up marrying a woman who is borderline mentally handicapped. He's got to do anything to keep this relationship, because if he can do it, he'll have a Hong Kong ID card. He can start a business. Even now, still on the brink of being not illegal anymore, he hires 3 people with Hong Kong ID cards. I mean, this guy is going to be a major business person, and this is his route to success. An incredibly nice guy, but he's exactly the kind of business person that I would think any society would want to have. You know, working all the time, not cheating people, a moral person, but, you know, he's driven for this. And I think it's great that he might stay in Hong Kong and do this, and I think this is a lesson for the developed world often. You know, very often you see that people in the developed world who are born there aren't as economically driven as these new people who come in. It is immigration that has made America the economic success that it's been, up until recently anyway, and that may continue. So open these borders, I would say.
Well, on that upbeat note, I think we have to draw to a conclusion. The FCC will present you with a survival package, which we hope that serves you well in your further researches in Chungking Mansions. And I understand that Professor will gladly have a private conversation with anyone who buys his book and asks him to sign it up here. Thank you all very much for coming.